Look to Windward, Cassette 2. Quillan was left alone with his thoughts. He realized how tense he had become communicating with the ghost of Hadesh Hyla, and deliberately relaxed his body, easing his muscles and straightening his back. Again, his gaze swept over the gleaming surfaces of the medical facility, but what he was seeing was the interior of the hull of the ship they were floating alongside, the privateer cruiser Winter Storm. He had been aboard the wreck once so far, while they were still trying to locate and extract Hyla's soul from the thousand or so others stored within the rescued substrate, which they'd located in the wreck with a specially adapted Navy drone. He had been promised that later, if there was time, he would be allowed to go back to the wreck with that drone and attempt to discover any other souls the original sweeps had missed. Time was running out, though. It had taken time to get permission for what he wanted to do, and it was taking time for the Navy technical people to adjust the machine. Meanwhile, they'd been told that the Culture warship was on its way, just a few days out. At the moment, the techs were pessimistic that they'd get the drone finished in time. The image of the wrecked ship's scooped-out hull seemed fixed in his brain.
Major Quillan?
Sir?
Reporting for duty, Major. Permission to come aboard?
Just so, sir. Sister technician, transfer Hadesh Hyla into the substrate within my body.
Directly, the female said. Proceeding.
He had wondered if he'd feel anything. He did. A tingling, then a warmth in a small area on the nape of his neck. The sister technician kept him informed. The transfer went well and took about 2 minutes. Checking it had gone perfectly took twice that time. What bizarre fates our technologies dream up for us, he thought as he lay there. Here I am, a male, becoming pregnant with the ghost of an old dead soldier, to travel beyond the bounds of light older than our civilization, and carry out some task I have spent the best part of a year training for, but of which I presently have no real knowledge whatsoever. The spot on his neck was cooling. He thought his head felt very slightly warmer than it had before. He might have been imagining it. You lose your love, your heart, your very soul, he thought, and gain a land destroyer, he heard her say, so falsely, bravely cheerful in his mind, while the rain-filled sky flashed above her and the vast weight pinned him utterly. Some memory of that pain and despair squeezed tears from his eyes.
Complete?
Testing, testing,
said the dry, laconic voice of Hadesh Hyla.
Hello, sir. You okay, son?
I'm fine, sir.
Did that hurt you there, Major? You seem a little distressed.
No, sir, just an old memory.
How do you feel? Pretty damned strange. I dare say I'll get used to it. Looks like everything checks out. Oh, shit! That female techie doesn't look any better through a male's eyes than she does through a camera.
Of course. What he could see, Hyla could see. Before he could reply, Hyla added,
You're sure you're okay?
Positive, sir. I'm fine. He stood within the hulk of the Winter Storm. The Navy drone went back and forth across the strange, almost flat floor of the wreck, searching in a grid pattern. It passed the hole in the floor where the substrate from Aeorm had been wrenched out. In the 2 days since they'd found the substrate, Quillan had persuaded the techs that it was worth recalibrating the drone to look for substrates much smaller than the one Hyla had been in. Substrates the size of a soul keeper, in fact. They had already performed a standard search, but he got them at least to try and look more closely. The mendicant sisters on the temple ship had helped with the persuading. Any chance to rescue a soul had to be pursued to the utmost. By the time the drone was ready, though, the culture ship which would take him on the first leg of his journey was already starting to decelerate. The Navy drone would have time for one sweep, and one sweep only. He watched it make its passes,
following its own unseen grid across the flat floor. He looked up and round the gaping shell of the ship's hull. He tried to recreate in his mind the interior of the vessel as it had been when it had been intact, and wondered in what part of it she had stayed, where she had moved, and where she had lain her head to sleep in the ship's false night. The main drive units might be up there, filling half the ship. The flyer hangar was there in the stern. The decks would spread here and here. Individual cabins would have been over there. Or over there. Maybe, he thought. Maybe there was still a chance. Maybe the techs had been wrong, and there was still something left to find. The hull only held because it was energized somehow. They still didn't understand everything about these great, gifted ships. Perhaps somewhere within the hull itself. The machine floated up to him, clicking. Ceiling lights glittering across its metallic carapace. He looked at it.
Sorry to break in, Quill, but it wants you to get the hell out of the way.
Oh, of course, sorry. Quillen stepped to one side. Not too clumsily, he hoped. It had been a while since he'd worn a suit.
I'll leave you alone again.
No, it's all right. Talk, if you want to talk. Okay. I've been wondering.
What? We've spent so much time doing technical calibrating stuff, but we haven't touched on some of the basic assumptions being made here. Like, is it really true we can hear each other when we talk like this, but not when we think? It seems a damn fine distinction to me.
Well, that's what we've been told. Why, have you had any hint of...
No. It's just that when you look at something through another person's eyes, and you think something, after a while you start to wonder if it's really what you think, or some sort of bleed-over from what they're thinking.
I think I see what you mean.
So, think we should test it out?
I suppose we could, sir.
All right. See if you can catch what I'm thinking.
Sir, I don't think... He thought, but there was silence, even as his own thoughts tailed off. He waited a few more moments, then a few more. The drone continued on its search pattern, each time passing by further and further away.
Well, catch anything?
No, sir.
You don't know what you missed, Major. Okay, your turn. Go on, think of something. Anything.
He sighed. The enemy ship... No, he shouldn't think of them that way. The ship could be here by now. He felt that what he and Hyla were doing right now was a waste of time, but on the other hand, there was nothing they could do to make the drone carry out its task any faster, so they weren't really wasting any time at all. All the same, it felt like it. What a strange interval, he thought. To be here in this hermetic mausoleum, standing in the midst of such forlorn desolation, with another mind inside his own, trading absences in the face of a task he knew nothing about. And so he thought of the long avenue at Old Breary in the fall, the way she scuffed through the amber drifts of fallen leaves, kicking golden explosions of leaves into the air. He thought of their marriage ceremony, in the gardens of her parents' estate, with the oval bridge reflected in the lake. As they'd made their vows, a wind out of the hills had ruffled the reflection and taken it away, snapping at the awning above them, blowing off hats and making the priest clutch at her robes. But the same strong, spring-scented breeze had stroked the tops of the veil trees and sent a shimmering white cloud of blossom falling around them, like snow. A few of the petals were still resting on her fur and eyelashes at the end of the service, when he turned to her, removed his own ceremonial muzzle and hers, and kissed her. Their friends and family hurrahed. hats were thrown into the air, and some were caught by another gust of wind to land in the lake and sail off across the little waves like a dainty flotilla of brightly coloured boats. He thought again of her face, her voice, those last few moments. "Live for me," he had said, and made her promise. How could they have known it would be a promise she could never keep, and he would still live to remember? Hyla's voice broke in.
"Done your thinking, Major?"
"Yes, sir. Did you catch anything?"
"No, just physiological stuff."
"Looks like we've still got some degree of privacy."
"Oh, the machine says it's finished."
Quillen looked at the drone, which had arrived at the far end of the spoon of floor.
"What does it..." "Oh, look, Hyla, can I talk to that thing directly?" "I think I can set that up now it's finished. I'll still be able to hear, though." "I don't mind. I just..." "There. Try it."
"Machine? Drone?"
"Yes, Major Quillen."
"Are there any other personality constructs in here, anywhere within the hull?"
"No.
Only the one I was tasked with discovering earlier, which now shares coordinates with yourself, that of Admiral General Hyla."
"Are you sure?" he asked, wondering if any hint of his hope and despair could colour his communicated words.
"Yes."
"What about within the fabric of the hull material itself?"
"That is not relevant."
"Have you scanned it?"
"I cannot. It is not open to my sensors." The machine was merely clever, not sentient. It would probably not have been able to recognize the emotions behind his words anyway, even if they had been communicated.
"Are you absolutely certain? Have you scanned everything?"
"I am certain, yes. The only three personalities present within the ship's hull in any form appreciable to my senses are you, the personality through which I am communicating to you, and my own."
He looked down at the swirl of floor between his feet. So there was no hope.
"I see," he thought. "Thank you."
"You are welcome."
Gone. Gone utterly and forever. Gone in a way that was new, bereft of the comforts of ignorance and without appeal. Before, we believed that the soul might be saved. Now, our technology, our better understanding of the universe, and our vanguard in the beyond has robbed us of our unreal hopes and replaced them with its own rules and regulations, its own algebra of salvation and continuance. It has given us a glimpse of heaven and made more intense the reality of our despair when we know that truly it exists and that those we love will never be found there. He switched on his communicator. There was a message waiting.
"They're here," said the letters on the suit's little screen.
It was timed 11 minutes earlier. A lot more time had passed than he'd have estimated.
"Looks like our ride's arrived."
"Yes, I'll let them know we're ready."
"You do that, Major."
"Major Quillen here," he transmitted. "I understand our guests have arrived."
"Major!"
It was the voice of Mission CO Colonel Ostromy.
"Everything all right in there?"
"Everything is fine, sir." He looked across the glassy floor and around the huge empty space.
"Just fine."
"Did you find what you were looking for, Quill?"
"No, sir. I did not find what I wanted."
"I'm sorry, Quill."
"Thank you, sir."
"You can open the hatchway again. The machine's finished its work. Let the techs see what else they can find by just digging."
"Opening now.
One of our guests wants to come and say hello."
"In here," he said, watching the tiny cone in the ship's bow hinge away.
"Yes. Is that okay with you?"
"I suppose." Quill looked back at the drone, which was hovering where it had completed its search.
Tell your machine to switch itself off first, will you? Done. The Navy drone settled to the floor. Okay, send them in when they're ready. The figure appeared in the blackness of the removed hatchway. It looked human, and yet could not be. One of them would have been no more able to survive in the vacuum without a suit than he was. Quillen upped the magnification on the visor, zooming in as the creature began to walk down the slope of the hull's interior. The biped had what looked like jet-black skin, and its clothing was shiny grey. It looked very thin, but then they all did. Its feet met the flat surface he was already standing on and brought it closer. It swung its arms as it walked.
They'd look like prey if there was just more eating on them.
He didn't reply. The zoomed window in the visor kept the creature at the same magnification until the distinction between the window and the rest of the view disappeared. The thing's face was narrow and pointed, its nose thin and sharp, and the eyes set in the night-black face were small and vividly blue, surrounded by white.
Shit, they don't look any more tight and clear up.
Major Quillen, the creature said. The skin above its eyes moved when it spoke to him, but not its mouth. Yes, he said. How do you do? I am the avatar of the Rapid Offensive Unit, Nuisance Value. Pleased to meet you. I've come to take you on the first leg of your trip to Masak Orbital. I see.
Quick suggestion. Ask how to address it.
Do you have a name or rank? What should I call you?
I am the ship, it said, raising and dropping its narrow shoulders. Call me Nuisance, if you like.
Its mouth twisted up at the edges.
Or Avatar, or just Ship.
Or just Abomination.
Very well. Ship.
Okay. It held up its hands. I just wanted to say hello personally. We'll be waiting for you. Let us know when you're ready to go. It let its gaze arc up and round. They said it was all right to come in here. I hope I didn't interrupt anything. I had finished in here. I was looking for something, but I didn't find it. I'm sorry.
So you should be, you worm fucker.
Yes, shall we go? He started towards the circle of night in the bow of the ship. The avatar fell into step alongside. Its gaze took in the floor briefly. What happened to this ship? We don't know exactly, he told it. It lost a battle. Something hit it very hard. The hull survived, but everything else inside it was destroyed. The avatar nodded. Compacted, fused state, it stated. And the crew? We are walking on them. I'm sorry. The creature immediately floated off the floor by half a meter. It stopped making the walking motion and posed itself as though sitting. It crossed its legs and arms. This happened in the war, I take it. They came to the slope and started up it. He kept on walking. He turned briefly to the creature. Yes, ship. It happened during your war. Chapter 3. Infra Dawn.
But you might die.
That's the whole point.
Really? I see.
No, I don't think you do you?
No.
The woman laughed and continued to adjust the flying harness. All about them, the landscape was the color of drying blood. Kabe stood on a rugged but still elegant platform, made from wood and stone, and perched on the edge of a long escarpment. He was talking with Feli Vitruve, a woman with wild black hair and deep brown skin over hard-looking muscles. She wore a tight blue bodysuit with a small belly pack and was in the process of strapping herself into a wing harness, a complicated device full of compressed, slatted fins that covered most of her rear surfaces,
from ankles to neck and down her arms. About 60 other people, half of them also wing flyers, were distributed about the platform, which was surrounded by the blimp tree forest. Dawn was just starting to break anti-spinwards, throwing long slanting rays across the cloud-wisped indigo sky. The fainter stars had long since been submerged in the slowly brightening vault. Barely a handful still twinkled. The only other heavenly objects visible were the lobed shape of Daughter Celi, the larger of the two ringed gas giants in the system, and the wavering white point that was the Nova, vastly distant atmosphere's escarpment's edge, across the dull islands of mist, and the low rolling hills, plains on the far side. The cries of the forest's nocturne disappeared over the past 20 minutes, and the calls of birds filled the night-chilled air above. Were dark domes, the taller ground-hugging trees. They looked threatening to Carbet, this ruddy glow. Black gas sacks loomed, shriveled and deflated, but still over the bloated bulb, while their strangle ached across the ground all around tentacles, establishing and keeping ordinary trees of the ground trees, and sing pleasantly. At first appeared not to be affected, then moved and crackling, act of monstrousness. Hundreds of meters away out of the scarp. Flyers had already disappeared, barely discernible paths, sea and forest, Int Valley, where the meander and oxbow lakes of Tulu be glimpsed through the slowly drift.
Hey. Ah.
Zilla, dark suit with only his hands and feet showing. Material covered the pad of his mid, reinforced with hide. It had been the Chelgrian who here originally to see the wing fly. Abe had already watched this, but albeit from a distance, shortly after he'd first then articulated river barge vessel's deck. This was the first time Kabe and since the gathering on the barge 5 days earlier, completed or put on hold their projects he had been working on, begun to study the material on Trions, which the contact Sono had sent him. He had half expected Zilla at all, and so the composer had left a message to him at the wing flyer's platform. Kerzilla, Felivit, as the Chelgrian loped up and crouched between her and Kabe. The woman flicked an arm out above the membrane, snapped out for a few translucent with a hint of blue, then flipped back. Enough, seemingly satisfied. We still haven't succeeded to have a go, no?
Oh, what about Kabe?
I'm too heavy,
Feli said.
Too heavy? You could fit him with a float harness. But that would be cheating.
I thought the whole point of this was to cheat.
Looked up from tightening a strap round her thigh. She grinned at the crouched Chelgrian.
Did you?
Cheating death.
Oh, that.
That's just a form of words, isn't it?
It is?
Yeah, it's cheat as in deprive.
Not cheating in the technical sense. Of agreeing to follow certain rules and then secretly not, while everybody else does. The Chelgrian was silent for a moment, then said,
"Mm-hmm."
The woman stood up straight, smiling.
When are we going to get a statement of mine you agree with, Kerzilla?
I'm not sure.
He glanced about the platform, where the remaining flyers were completing their preparations, and the others were packing up breakfast picnics and transferring to the various small aircraft hovering silently nearby.
Isn't all of this cheating?
Feli exchanged shouts of good luck and last-minute advice with a few of her fellow wing flyers. Then she looked at Kabe and Zilla and nodded towards one of the aircraft.
Come on, we'll cheat and take the easy way.
The aircraft was a little arrowhead-shaped sliver of a thing, with a large open cabin. Kabe thought it looked more like a small motorboat than a proper plane. He guessed it was big enough to take about 8 humans. He weighed the same as 3 of the bipeds, and Zilla was probably almost the mass of 2, so they should be under its maximum capacity, but it still didn't look up to the task. It wobbled very slightly as he stepped aboard. Seats morphed and rearranged themselves for the 2 non-human shapes. Feli Vitruve swung into the lead seat with a sort of clacking noise from the stowed wing fins, which she flicked out of the way as she sat. She pulled a control grip from the cockpit's fascia and said,
Manual, please, Hub.
You have control, the machine said. The woman clicked the grip into place and, after a look around, pulled, twisted and pushed it to send them gently backing out and away from the platform, and then racing off just above the tops of the ground trees. Some sort of field prevented more than a gentle breeze from entering the passenger compartment. Kabe reached out and poked it with one finger, feeling an invisible plastic resistance.
So how is all of this cheating? Feli called back.
Zilla looked over the side.
Could you crash this?
He asked casually. She laughed.
Is that a request?
No, just a question.
Want me to try?
Not particularly.
Well then, no, I probably couldn't. I'm flying it, but if I did anything really stupid, the automatics would take over and haul us out of trouble.
Is that cheating?
Depends. Not what I call cheating.
She angled the craft down towards a group of blimp trees in a large clearing.
I'd call it a reasonable combination of fun and safety.
She turned back to glance at them. The craft wriggled fractionally in the air, aiming between two tall ground trees.
Though, of course, a purist might say I shouldn't be using an aircraft to get to my blimp in the first place.
The trees rushed past, one on either side, very close. Kabe felt himself flinch. There was a hint of a thud, and when he looked back, Kabe saw a few leaves and twigs whirling and falling in their slipstream. The craft bellied down towards the largest blimp tree, aiming close in, underneath the curve of the gas sack, where the giant tentacle roots joined together and merged into the dark brown, bulbous pod of the Banner Reservoir.
A purist would walk, suggested Zilla.
Yup.
The woman made a sort of tapping down motion with the grip, and the craft settled onto the roots. She stowed the grip control in the panel in front of her.
Here's our boy, she said,
nodding up at the dark black-green balloon blotting out most of the morning sky. The blimp tree towered 15 meters over them, casting a deep shadow. The gas sack's surface was rough and veined, and yet still looked thin as paper, giving the impression of having been sewn together clumsily from giant leaves. Kabe thought it looked like a thundercloud.
How would they get here in the first place, to this forest? Zilla asked.
I think I see what you're getting at, Feli said, jumping out of the craft and landing on a broad route.
She checked her harness points again, squinting at them in the semi-darkness.
Most of them would come by underground, she said,
glancing round at the blimp tree, and then up at the ruby light sifting through the ground trees.
A few would power glide, she added,
frowning at the blimper, which seemed to be stretching, tautening. Kabe thought he detected sounds coming from the Banner Reservoir.
Some would take an aircraft, she went on,
then flashed a smile at them, and said,
Excuse me, I think it's time I got into place.
She took a pair of long gloves from the belly pack and pulled them on. Curved nails, half as long as her fingers, extended from their tips when she flexed them. Then she turned and clambered up the side of the reservoir pod until she was at its lip, where the springy material curled under the blimp. The tree was creaking loudly now, the gas sack expanding and becoming taut.
Others might come by ground car, or bike, or boat, and then walk, Feli went on, settling down in a crouch on the lip of the reservoir. Of course, the real purists, the sky junkies, they live out here in huts and tents and survive off hunting and wild fruits and vegetables. They travel everywhere on foot or by wing, and you never see them in town at all. They live for flying. It's a ritual, a... what do you call it? A sacrament. Almost a religion with them. They hate people like me because we do it for fun. Lot of them won't talk to us. Actually, some of them won't talk to each other. And I think some have lost the power of speech altogether. Feli turned away as the blimp suddenly parted company with the Banner Reservoir and rose into the sky like a giant black bubble from a vast brown mouth.
Beneath the gas sack, attached to it by a thick mass of filaments, rose a broad green streamer of tissue-thin leaf, 8 meters across and webbed with darker veins. Feli Vitruve stood, flicked out the claws in her gloves, and flung herself at the mass of filaments just under the blimp, thumping into the great curtain of leaf and making it shudder and ripple. She kicked at it with her feet, and more blades punctured the membrane. The blimp hesitated in its ascent, then continued up into the sky. Released from the shadow of the blimp, the air around the aircraft seemed to lighten as the huge shape swept into the still brightening sky with a noise like a sigh. "Ha-ha!" shouted Feli. Zilla leant over to Kabe.
"Shall we follow her?"
"Why not?"
"A flying machine," Zilla said.
"Hub here, Kerzilla," said a voice from their seats' headrests.
"Take us up. We'd like to follow Miss Vitruve."
"Certainly." The aircraft rose almost straight up, smoothly and quickly, until they were level with the black-haired woman, who had twisted so that she faced out from the banner under the blimp. Kabe looked over the side of the craft. They were about 60 meters up by now, and gaining height at a respectable rate. Looking right down, he could see into the blimper's base pod, where the reams of banner leaf unfolded from their reservoir and were hauled rippling into the air. Feli Vitruve smiled broadly at them, her body being pulled this way and that as the banner leaf flapped and ruffled in the roaring wind of the plant's ascent.
"Okay there,"
she said, laughing. Her hair flew about her face and she kept shaking her head.
"Oh, I think we're fine,"
Zilla shouted.
"And you?"
"Never better,"
the woman yelled, looking up at the blimp and then down at the ground.
"To go back to this thing about cheating," Zilla said.
She laughed.
"Yes? What?"
"This whole place is a cheat."
"How so?"
She flicked one hand and hung dangerously by a single arm, while her other hand, claws stowed, brushed her hair away from her mouth. The movement made Kabe nervous. If he'd been her, he'd have worn a cap or something.
"It's made to look like a planet," Zilla shouted. "It's not."
Kabe was watching the still rising sun. It was bright red now. An orbital sunrise, like an O sunset, took much longer than the same event on a planet. The sky above you brightened first, then the rising star seemed to coalesce out of the infrared, a shimmering vermilion spectre emerging out of the haze line, and then sliding along the horizon, shining dimly through the plate walls and the distant abundances of air, and only gradually gaining height, though once it had properly begun, the daylight lasted longer than on a globe. All of which was arguably a gain, Kabe thought, as sunset and sunrises often produced the day's more spectacular and attractive vistas.
"So what?"
Feli had both hands anchored again.
"So why bother with this?"
Zilla shouted, indicating the blimp.
"Fly up here. Use a floater harness.
Do it all in a dream? Do it all in VR?" she laughed.
"Would it be any less false?"
"That's not the question. The question is, would it be any less fun?"
"Well, would it?"
she nodded vigorously.
"Abso-fucking-lutely!"
Her hair, caught in a sudden updraft, swirled above her head like black flames.
"So you only think it's fun if there's a certain degree of reality involved?"
"It's more fun," she shouted. "Some people blimp jump as their main recreation, but they only ever do it in..."
Her voice was lost as a gust of wind roared around them. The blimper shuddered and the aircraft trembled a fraction.
"In what?"
Zilla bellowed.
"In dreams," she shouted. "There are VR wing flyer purists who make a point of never doing the real thing."
"Do you despise them?"
Zilla yelled. The woman looked mystified. She
She leant out from the rippling membrane, then detached one hand. This time she left the glove where it was, anchored in the thick filament membrane, dug in her belly pack, and clipped something tiny to one nostril. Then she put her hand back into the glove and relaxed back. When she spoke again, it was in a normal speaking voice, and relayed through Kabe's own nose ring and whatever terminal setup Zilla was using, it was as though she was sitting right beside each of them. "Despise them, did you say?"
"Yes," said Zilla.
"Why in the world would I despise them?"
"They achieve with minimal effort and no risk what you have to gamble your life on."
"That's their choice. I could do that too if I wanted. And anyway," she said, glancing up at the blimp above her, then taking a longer look at the skies around, "it's not exactly the same thing you achieve, is it?"
"Isn't it?"
"No. You know you've been in VR, not reality."
"You could fake that too."
She appeared to sigh, then grimaced. "Look, sorry, it's time to fly, and I prefer to be alone. No offence." She took her hand out of the glove again, put the nose stud terminal in her belly pack, and, after a struggle, got her hand back in the glove. Kabe thought she looked cold. They were over half a kilometre above the escarpment now, and the air spilling over the aircraft's fields felt chill on his carapace. Their rate of ascent had slowed appreciably, and Feli's hair was blowing out to one side rather than whipping all about her head. "See you later," she yelled through the air. Then she let go. She leant out, gloves coming free first, then boots. Kabe saw the shining claws flick back in, reflecting orange-yellow in the sunlight as she dropped away. Released, the blimp set off into the sky again. Kabe and Zilla looked out over the same side of the aircraft. It pushed back, keeping level, then spun around so they could watch the woman as she swooped. She kicked her legs and threw out her arms. The wing slats deployed, turning her in a single flicker into a giant blue-green bird. Over the noise of the wind, Kabe heard her wild yahooing. She curved away, heading towards the sunrise, then kept on turning and disappeared momentarily behind the banner leaf. In the skies around them, Kabe could make out a handful of other flyers, tiny dots and shapes angling through the air beneath the tethered balloons of the risen blimp trees. Feli was banking round, gaining height now, heading back on a rising curve that would take her underneath them. The aircraft swiveled slowly in the air, keeping her in view. She passed 20 meters beneath them, performing a roll and yelling at them, a huge grin on her face. Then she swung back over, to present her back to the sky and swooped again, pulling her wings in and tearing away and down. She seemed to be diving into the ground.
"Oh,"
Kabe heard himself say. Suppose she died? He had already started to compose in his head the next voice piece he would send to the Homomdan far-flung correspondence news service. Kabe had been sending these illustrated letters back home every 6 days for nearly 9 years now, and had built up a small but devoted band of listeners. He had never had to describe an accidental death in one of his recordings, and he did not relish the idea of doing so now. Then the blue-green wings flicked out again, and the woman rose once more a kilometre away, before finally disappearing behind a fence of banner leaves.
"Our angel is not immortal, is she?" Zilla asked.
"No," Kabe said.
He was not sure what an angel was, but thought it would be rude to ask either Zilla or Hub for the information.
"No, she's not backed up."
Feli Vitruve was one of about half of the wing flyers for whom no recording of her mind state existed to revive them if they dived into the ground and were killed. It gave Kabe an unpleasant feeling just thinking about it.
"They call themselves the Disposables," he said.
Zilla was silent for a moment.
Strange that people are happy to adopt epithets they would fight to the death to throw off had they been imposed. A yellow-orange highlight reflected off part of the aircraft's bright work. There is a Chelgrian caste called the Invisibles.
I know.
Zilla looked up. Yes. How are your studies going?
Oh, well enough. I've only had 4 days, and there were various pieces of my own I've had to finish. However, I've made a start.
An unenviable task you've taken on, Carbe. I'd offer an apology on behalf of my species, except I feel it would be superfluous, as that is more or less what my entire body of work consists of.
Oh, now, Carbe said, embarrassed.
To feel such shame for one's own was, well, shameful. Whereas this lot, Zilla said, nodding over the side of the aircraft at the wheeling dots of the wing flyers, are just odd. He settled back in his seat and produced his pipe from a pocket. Shall we stay here a while and admire the sunrise?
Yes, Carbe said. Let's.
From up here, they could see for hundreds of kilometers across Fretl Plate. The system's star, Lassalier, was still rising and slowly yellowing to full brightness, shining through the continents of air to anti-spinward, its radiance obliterating any detail on the lands still in shade. To spinward, beneath the fuzzily broad, then sharp but slowly diminishing line of the plates that had risen into full sunlight, hanging in the sky like a bright, beaded bracelet, the Tulia Mountains rose, capes of snow about their shoulders. Spin right, the view just faded away across the savannas, disappearing into haze. Left, there was a hint of hills in the blue distance, one edge of a broad estuary, where Massac Great River decanted into Fretl Sea and the waters beyond.
This ends side one of cassette 2.